Hey y'all, I'm Dan, and I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey, y'all. I'm your host, Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. Finally freaking doing it.
Oh my God. Are we covering Dr. Feelgood?
Not yet, but we will be. We are doing the case that we say we would never cover before. A case that to us doesn't seem to add up, but to everyone else it seems to add up. We are going to be doing the case of the Mad Butcher of West Virginia. Okay, Court, so between July of 1962 and December of 1963, seven men disappeared from southern West Virginia. Only two bodies were ever recovered, and how the bodies were found gave the killer a forever name, christened the Mad Butcher of West Virginia.
In February of 1962, 29-year-old Robert Mack Agee, a former resident of Fayette County, was actually returning to his hometown of Kingston from his home that he just newly moved to in Chicago.
Where is Kingston in Fayette County?
It's near Mossy. So Mack visited his mom in a local nursing home and was scheduled to meet with other family and friends later in Kingston. Mack didn't have a car and he was going to hitchhike from the nursing home. Sadly, he never made it to Kingston. His family and friends just assumed that he returned to Chicago, and they didn't report his disappearance to local authorities. It was found out later that Mack actually never returned to Chicago or to work. So in July of 1964, authorities received a call from Michigan saying that Mack had not been seen since February of 1962.
So basically, like, let's wait 2 years to let authority know that, like, oh, this guy's missing.
What's weird is the rumors went around saying that Mack was alive and working back in Chicago. Like, 1 week after these reports were released, the West Virginia State Police announced that they confirmed that Mack was alive and working in Chicago. Later, the reports were found out to be false, and the fate of Robert Mack Agee remains a mystery.
Ernest Gwynn was 75 years old when he disappeared on July 3, 1962. He was a retired railroader. His wife, Mary Josephine Gwynn, passed away in August of 1950. The couple had two sons, Bernice and Nicholas, who lived in Charleston, West Virginia, and Kentucky. Ernest, you know, he wasn't a big guy. He was only 5'9", weighed about 170 pounds. He had gray hair and he was balding on the top. Now, Ernest was said to be a creature of habit. He lived at a local boarding house. I've seen images, and in every single thing I have seen, they always say this one building is the Virginian Hotel where he lived. It's not. It is actually the Hotel Hill. The boarding house he lived in, you know me, I went searching for it because I'm like, it is in the Hotel Hill, so there has to be one somewhere. I did find a boarding house on Central Avenue in Oak Hill, but turns out there was actually a Virginian Hotel. It was where Wendy's is today in Oak Hill, which It's odd. I feel like everything in Oak Hill kind of happens around the Wendy's.
Oh my God, it does.
I mean, you have the convalescent where Teresa and Woods was walking to.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the 4-minute lunch. So the owner of the boarding house owned the 4-minute lunch, which, you know, was right across the road from where Wendy's is today. And Ernest was known to, you know, walk across the street and eat there a lot. And Court, I really wish I could say there was more, but there's really only 2 stories known about Ernest.
Okay.
So on the evening of July 3rd, 1962, Ernest, you know, cashed his pension check to pay his rent, which from what I hear was, you know, usual for him. He went to the 4-minute lunch for dinner.
So did the rent take up like his entire check?
No, he actually put like the rest of his money in his pocket. So after he ate dinner, he drank a few beers, visited with everyone. He said bye to everyone and headed home, which, you know, should kind of be just a walk across the street. But after this, no one knows what happened to him. He didn't show up to the 4-minute lunch on July 4th, which, you know, was a normal routine for him. And the second story is that Ernest may have went to the VFW in Oak Hill. The time he was last seen seems to be after he left the 4-minute lunch. It's said that people saw him with 3 young men, Paul Tiger of Fayetteville, Bill Douglas of Oak Hill, and Lewis Starson of Minden. So the 3 men were actually charged with the kidnapping of 68-year-old George Hess. The reason police became suspicious of the 3 is that they learned that they picked Hess up from the 4-minute lunch before driving him around and beating him up and taking his $75. The family of Ernest Gwynn offered a $200 reward, which would be $2,096.70. They hoped that the reward would lead to the discovery of Ernest, but sadly to this day, Ernest Gwynn has never been found.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
4 months later, there was another disappearance. This time, it was 33-year-old Sammy Smith, who was a resident of Scarborough, West Virginia. Sammy returned to Oak Hill after working on the farm in Connecticut, and he also worked odd jobs in Oak Hill. And on the day he disappeared, Sammy worked as a dishwasher at the 4-minute lunch in Oak Hill.
Of course he did.
Around midnight on October 20th, 1962, Sammy was seen at the Top Hat Drive-In, which was located in Hilltop, West Virginia. So for our locals, this is actually across from where the WOAY TV station is.
Which, I never knew that. I always thought, you know, oh, it's just an empty lot. I never knew that the Top Hat Drive-In was right there. And I mean, how many times have we driven by it?
Quite a bit.
Literally, yeah.
It was reported that Sammy ordered a cup of coffee and talked to some long-haul truckers and employees of the Top Hat Drive-In. Sammy didn't own a vehicle, so he got around by hitchhiking or walking. It said that Sammy was walking towards his home in Scarborough. On the night he was last seen, witnesses near the drive-in in the WOAY studio reported seeing Sammy walking towards a dirt road, which was a shortcut for him. The road, it is believed, Sammy walked was Blaketown Road, and it's reported that he may have been carrying a large amount of money at the time. On the same night, Sammy was wearing a blue jacket, a dark sports shirt, a pair of brown pants, and black shoes. His disappearance wasn't known for over 2 weeks. It was said in an article that foul play is suspected in the disappearance of a Scarborough man, Samuel William Sammy Smith, 33, who was last seen October 20th. State police, who are investigating Smith's mysterious disappearance, said it is unusual for Smith to leave his home without letting his parents know his whereabouts. Smith, who worked odd jobs, cleaned Joe's lunch in Oak Hill the day of his disappearance and was last seen at midnight at the Top Hat Drive-In near the radio TV station. The man is 5'8" tall, has hazel eyes, black hair, and was wearing a blue jacket, dark sports shirt, brown pants, and black shoes when he was last seen. His parents, Mr. and Mrs. Wayman Smith, Scarborough, with whom he lived, said he might possibly have an unusually large amount of cash in his possession. He had recently returned around the country picking apples and had a total of a summer's pay. Of this money, some was given to his parents, some was deposited in the bank, and it's believed Smith had the remainder, about $55, with him. Mr. and Mrs. Smith had issued a plea to have hunters in the area to be on the lookout for their son and to report any knowledge of his whereabouts to the state police or the sheriff's department. So with two disappearances, there wasn't fear among the general public, but that would all change.
2 months later, on December 27th, and about 20 miles away from Oak Hill, 11-year-old Billy Priest was walking Golly Mountain for bottle caps when he discovered the remains of Mike Rogers, who had been missing since December 19th. Mike was completely naked, and his body had been chopped into 13 pieces. An autopsy confirmed that Mike had been shot in the back of the head with a .22 caliber firearm, and he wasn't alive when his body was separated. This is what caused the calm to turn into quick panic. The nature of his death sent shockwaves throughout the entire state. It wasn't unusual to see Mike on the streets of Oak Hill. He was 18 years old and suffered from a mild mental handicap. And despite his setbacks, Mike was known to be a harmless guy who could be found greeting locals with his transistor radio held up to one ear. Like Ernest and Sammy, Mike didn't drive, but he would walk or hitchhike to wherever he needed to go. Mike lived with his foster parents in the community of Salem Road, which is located northeast of Oak Hill. Mike was last seen on December 19th, 1962, and for most of that day, he helped with various odd jobs around Salem Road and Oak Hill. Around 4 p.m., he went home for dinner, and let me tell you, this boy was hungry. He ate 5 hot dogs with ketchup and chili. Then around 5 p.m., he left home telling his mom he was going to go to Oak Hill to buy a pack of cigarettes and look at all of the Christmas lights. At 6 p.m., Mike was seen by Jimbo Moore near the intersection of Salem Road and U.S. Route 21. Mike asked for a ride to Oak Hill. Now, this is kind of effed up in my opinion. Mike asked Jimbo for a ride, but Jimbo told him that he had to run an errand and that he would run back by the location soon to pick him up and give him a ride then.
Do we actually know what the errand was?
Sadly, I don't, unless it's in police documents, and I think those are sealed up or either lost. I just couldn't imagine leaving someone behind. Just, like, bring him with you and then take him home after you're done, or take him to Oak Hill after you're done.
Do you think he felt unsafe?
I mean, there's a good possibility. So like 30 minutes later, Jimbo returned to the intersection, but Mike wasn't there anymore.
So do we know if he got a ride from somebody else or if he started to walk back home?
I really wish I had that answer. Mike Rogers was last seen at the intersection of State Route 16 and Gatewood Avenue. 8 days later, his remains were found about 10 feet off US 60 on Golly Mountain, just 5 miles away from Hawksnest State Park, which I'm kind of shocked we've never been there together.
And we have been over Golly Mountain a ton.
So one thing I want to point out is how his body was found. A lot of the facts haven't been released, but what has been released is that his body was chopped into 13 pieces. What I do know is that his body was found about 400 yards west of the entrance of the Hawk's Nest Country Club. Now, another thing that was released is that Mike was more than likely killed in a kneeling position. It was determined that he was killed 48 hours prior to the discovery of his body. However, it was later said that his death could have been between 6:30 p.m. and 2 a.m. on the day Mike disappeared.
It could have happened 30 minutes after Jimbo saw him.
Yeah, which is crazy, right?
It's really weird.
Like, I mean, yeah, it is weird. And, like, we're not pointing fingers at Jimbo, but it's just one of those odd things that just, like, happened in these cases. Some of Mike's organs were not found at the scene, although authorities weren't 100% sure if it was the work of the killer or just animal activity. An examination of Mike's skin revealed that his body had been frozen, then thawed. It's thought that the killer may have used a cleaver or an axe to dismember Mike's body. Mike's clothing was missing, and 9 of his personal items were never found. No weapons or other tools were found at the scene. The only items that were there was a plastic bag and an army duffel bag, which had some of Mike's body placed in it. Authority thought, well, maybe this duffel bag would lead to the killer. I mean, it was an army-issued bag, and it had the name J.L. Howard on it. But looking into it, authorities found out that Howard lost the bag in 1959 while he was en route from Michigan to South Carolina, which the trip did take him through West Virginia, actually on Route 21. He recalled stopping at a Greyhound bus stop in Charleston, West Virginia, and he didn't realize that his bag was missing until later. The bag was randomly found at a Greyhound bus stop in Georgia. Sadly, the duffel bag has disappeared from the state police evidence room in Oak Hill. The discovery of Mike's remains sent a chill down the spine of law enforcement. Like, the possibility of the connection between Mike, Sammy, and Ernest was inescapable at this point. They feared that they were dealing with a serial killer, later called the Mad Butcher by press.
On May 28, 1963, a railroad crew was working on telephone boxes between Claremont and Fair when a cloudburst popped out of nowhere. They ran to a cliff to get some shelter from the storm. The cliff was 100 feet away from where they were working, and they thought they saw a hornet's nest, but it turned out to be a human skull. Examination of the skull showed it had apparently been pierced by a small caliber bullet. The Fayette County coroner said that the condition and number of teeth was consistent with the teeth of Ernest Gwynn. His two sons also examined the skull and confirmed that the shape of the head and the teeth matched their father's. However, Ernest's dentist couldn't weigh in on the issue because the records he had for Ernest had already been destroyed.
How could you get rid of records that quick? Like, I feel like you need to keep them for like a year or two, you know, just, you know, in case he is found and they have to, like, identify him.
They performed a search of the area and nothing else turned up. The skull was later sent to the FBI in Washington, D.C. However, they were unable to make a positive identification.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're
Country Roads Creeps.
We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right, well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
On July 27, 1963, 42-year-old Lewis Bennett left his home on Summerlee Avenue in Oak Hill. He walked the 6 blocks south to Main Street. And this may shock you, but he made his way to the 4-minute lunch. He was seen talking to an unidentified female and he was seen buying her 2 or 3 beers while talking to her. Someone overheard Lewis tell her that he planned to disappear in the near future and that he didn't have long to live. Not too long after this, Lewis ordered a 6-pack of beers and left the 4-minute at lunch. People recalled seeing him walking along the railroad tracks between Main Street and his home. 2 weeks into his disappearance, authorities were thinking that maybe he just left on his own. For 22 months, his fate was a disappearance. On May 19th, 1965, children playing along the railroad tracks between Minden and Thurman happened upon another human skull. Police were called to the scene and discovered more remains, clothing, and personal items in a nearby ravine. Items found with the remains included a battery, detonation cable, and a leather belt which the buckle was initialed with the letter B. A month later, the remains were identified as Lewis Bennett. And to me, I just don't see him being a part of this list. I feel like it was suicide because he said himself that he was going to disappear and that he didn't have long to live. So, I hate to say it, but I feel like he strapped some dynamite to him and just blew himself up there on the railroad tracks.
On November 22nd, 1963, 33-year-old Shirley Jean Arthur was visiting with his girlfriend and her parents in Sophia, West Virginia. According to Mr. and Mrs. Taylor, Arthur left their home around 11 p.m. to hitchhike back to his home in Bradley, West Virginia. His sister told newspapers that her brother was last seen in Sophia at 2 a.m., 3 hours after he left his girlfriend's home.
Which makes no sense.
Right? He wasn't reported missing until December 8th. On Saturday, December 7th, 1963, 3 teenagers were looking for firewood in Indian Creek when they came upon a body 25 feet from the road. The body was dismembered, cut into 2 sections. The upper part of the body was found within canvas wrapped in wire, and the lower part was found about 4 feet away. The arms, head, and legs below the knees were removed and never located. Authorities estimated that his body had been dumped at the site a day or two before being found. The autopsy revealed 19 separate puncture wounds to the heart. The weapon was suspected to be an ice pick type of instrument. The exact cause of death couldn't be determined. Ned Rogers, the Wyoming County coroner, thought that maybe the killer made it appear that the unknown man had been killed by a shotgun, but no bullets were found. The family of Shirley Arthur traveled to Pineville to look at the remains. Their conclusions were split. His mother and ex-wife made positive identification, while Arthur's brother did not. An examination of the stomach contents settled the mind of law enforcement. The medical examiner found traces of green beans, pepper and tomato stew, hot dogs, and yellow apple. An exact match to the meal that was served at the Taylor's home the night of November 22nd.
Now, Court, you may remember the day of December 7th well. We've talked about it a lot on this podcast, but we won't be talking about it today. Everyone, and I mean every single person that does research on this case, thinks that James Lee Haynes was the next victim of the Mad Butcher because the woman who dropped him off in Oak Hill was like, hey, I dropped James Lee Haynes off in Oak Hill. That's the last place he was ever seen. And he isn't a victim of the Mad Butcher. And for those who don't believe me, maybe you will one day. And maybe I will get to share everything that is in this folder, because this has everything anyone needs to know about this case. But until that day comes, you can listen to the 2 episodes we have released on James Lee Haynes. It was our 2nd episode in season 1, and we actually revisited his case not too long ago. So maybe one day we can bring you an update on the case of James Lee Haynes.
The Mad Butcher's killings in West Virginia came to an end after this. The story had returned to the headlines on and off throughout the years. In 1991, the Registered Herald published an article on the Mad Butcher along with some other unsolved crimes.
Within 3 years, Crime Stoppers came to West Virginia, which, I'm not sure if anyone knows this, their first detachment was in Raleigh County. Over the years, more and more articles have been released. There's actually a book in the works right now on the Mad Butcher. I don't know what you think about this, but to me, there isn't a Mad Butcher in West Virginia. I could be wrong. I just find it hard to believe that a lot of these things add up. In reality, there was only two things shared within these seven cases. All of the men were white, and all of them were hitchhiking or walking. Which to me, Court, is the only thing connecting any of these cases.
And something that, like, I picked up while we were going through all of this, I seriously feel that whoever committed the murder of these folks, they done it on the most vulnerable people that they were. Mm-hmm. They were older in age, and the woman was disabled. They had to be so vulnerable. And in my book, it had to be somebody who knew them because they knew that they carried large sums of money upon them. Mm-hmm. And things of that nature. Who's not to say that we possibly haven't gave the name of the people who actually committed the murders here today on this podcast?
Five out of the seven were residents of Fayette County. Only three had ties to the four-minute lunch. Only two of the victims were identified with 100% accuracy.
And what about Shirley Arthur?
Well, it was never 100% certain that it was him. The body was actually buried in an unmarked grave, I want to say in Wyoming County. Two of the bodies were dismembered after death. Two were shot in the head. At the end of the day, Court, to me, it's just hard to say that there was a Mad Butcher in West Virginia.
We're asking all of our followers, what do you think? Let us know on our socials if you think that there was a Mad Butcher of West Virginia.
If you have any information on any of these cases, please contact the Fayette County Sheriff's Department or the Oak Hill Detachment of the West Virginia State Police. We will be taking next week off, but we will be returning the following week with a new case. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find a good West Virginia true crime podcast.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Mountain State Mysteries.
Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.
For the show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com.